It is Friday, January 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump defends his America First policy to world leaders.
So it was really a speech that urged foreign business leaders to consider investing in America.
Two newspapers say President Trump tried to fire special counsel Robert Mueller last June, and three prominent music entertainers prepare to retire. It's all ahead. U.S. President Donald Trump told a gathering of global business and political leaders Friday that the world will benefit from U.S. economic power and invited them to join him. Trump spoke to the closing session of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland.
But America First does not mean America alone. When the United States grows, so does the world.
Trump praised the current status of the U.S. economy.
After years of stagnation, the United States is once again experiencing strong economic growth. The stock market is smashing one record after another and has added more than $7 trillion in new wealth since my election.
Trump defended his promotion of the American economy.
As President of the United States, I will always put America first, just like the leaders of other countries should put their country first also.
Gary Huffbauer is a senior fellow at the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics and spoke with me about Trump's speech.
The speech was surprisingly moderate, considering the range of statements that President Trump has made about international trade agreements over the last year. And he really concentrated, as you said, on the good things happening in the American economy. Employment is way up, unemployment is down, business is investing, the stock market is extremely strong, as he mentioned a couple of times. And of course, the tax bill recently enacted makes the U.S. a more attractive place to do business. So it was really a welcome speech that urged foreign business leaders to consider investing in America and doubted the strong features of the American economy, the labor force, the skills, and so forth. It was not at all confrontational.
Yeah, because going into this, there were some observers believed that this would have been, a tough crowd for Mr. Trump. This is, I believe he had sort of criticized this as sort of an international elite, but he seemed to get a fairly warm civil reception.
Oh, yes, he got a very warm reception. And of course, he could have thrown in some barbs about the nature of the crowd. You know, it is obviously a very elite group, but he didn't do any, made no kind of gratuitous remarks. In fact, he praised them and praised the small meetings he had with some of the business leaders last night or yesterday. And so it was kind of, on the whole, almost a very traditional type of Davos speech.
Trump, however, he did have a warning for world leaders, saying that the U.S. would not agree to what he considers another unfair trade agreement. He has been quite critical of those in the past.
Yes, he did. He did slip that in, but it wasn't the dominant theme. His code words are: it's got to be a fair agreement, it's got to be reciprocal, and it seems that what he means by reciprocal is that there should not be big trade surpluses or deficits by either of the partners. And then he had special words for China, criticizing China on intellectual property acquisition, a combination of espionage, forced technology transfer, and so forth. He kind of wrapped all into China not playing fair, and also China subsidizing its state-owned enterprises. So there was criticism of China in the speech.
But I don't think he mentioned China by name.
No, he definitely did not. But I think the references were pretty clear.
Gary Huffbauer, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's trending?
Well, what is trending is what you were just talking about, as a matter of fact, this big World Economic Forum that's being held in Davos right now, where the president spoke. One thing that the crowd may have given him a warm reception at one point, but Mr. Trump also got booed, and that's getting a lot of attention in social media. Apparently, in remarks, in sort of a kind of give and take with the press, he described the press as being nasty, mean, and fake. And he got a pretty loud round of boo. So that's what a lot of people are talking about. But the hashtag Davos is trending right now. Here's Adam Schiff. He's a member of Congress, a Democratic member of Congress. Trump goes to Davos having insulted many of the world leaders there to tell them to put America first. Apparently, this is the difference between a really smart diplomatic strategy and one that is only, quote, like really smart. That reference to a comment Mr. Trump had made earlier. Vice President Mike Pence, under the Trump administration, the policy of the United States of America is to place the security and prosperity of America first. But as the president has made clear, America first does not mean America alone. Here's a Bernie Sanders, senator, independent senator, who had a presidential bid unsuccessful in 2016. While Donald Trump and the, quote, masters of the universe assemble in Davos, the six richest people own as much wealth as the bottom half of the world's population. That's about 3.7 billion people. We need a global economy that works for all, not just for multinational corporations and the very, very rich. There's lots of other people talking about what's happening at Davos, and I think it's a way for people to kind of channel their just sort of overall feelings at this point, just a little over 1 year into the Trump administration. If you're generally favorably inclined to view the president favorably, I think people are, you know, inclined to reflect that in what they're hearing from the president in Davos. If you do not look so kindly on the president, then you're going to hear other things and be kind of talking about other things. So that's really what's getting a lot of people talking today. I think in some ways, this is also just a measure of there's just not a lot happening today. To be honest, because I can't imagine Davos is that fascinating. But anyway, that's certainly one item that's trending today.
Okay, thanks, Doug. And we will have a little bit more on that sort of booing situation coming up later in the show. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Afghan fighting kills at least 7 civilians. 30 migrants and refugees are found dead off the coast of Yemen. The White House puts a high price tag on the border wall with Mexico, and Venezuela excludes the opposition from a presidential vote. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study outlines the discovery of the most distant supermassive black hole to date. The monster black hole has been calculated to be roughly 13 billion light years from Earth. This means that it was formed a mere 690 million years after the Big Bang. An international group of scientists calculated the mass of the black hole to be 800 million times that of our sun. Study co-author Daniel Stern of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory says the discovery of the distant supermassive black hole challenges current theories about how black holes form. The scientists found that the giant black hole is gobbling matter up so quickly that it has become a quasar, which are among the brightest known celestial objects in the universe. Supermassive black holes are found in the center of large galaxies like our own Milky Way. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we have a report on how U.S. smoking rates are down, but the results are uneven. President Trump has dismissed New York Times and Washington Post stories that he wanted to fire special counsel Robert Mueller in June, but backed off when the White House counsel threatened to quit. He described the accounts to reporters at the World Economic Summit in Davos, Switzerland, as fake news, typical New York Times fake news. In Davos Friday, Trump took aim at the media.
And it wasn't until I became a politician that I realized how nasty, how mean, how vicious, and how fake the press can be as the cameras start going off in the background.
Mueller is investigating allegations the Trump campaign colluded with Russia in interfering in the 2016 presidential election. He's also looking into possible obstruction of justice by the White House. The report said White House counsel Don McGahn refused to pass on the president's order to fire Mueller to the Justice Department. Alan Lichtman is professor of history at American University, and he tells me there are parallels in between this story to the Watergate scandal that toppled President Richard Nixon in 1974.
What is so striking about Trump's response to the Russia controversy is that it almost directly parallels Nixon's cover-up of the Watergate scandal. Deny, conceal, delay. And then when you're caught, say, oh, whatever we were doing was innocuous anyway. Just like the Nixon team said, Watergate was nothing more than a third-rate burglary. None of the denials, none of the explanations by the president or the White House can be taken at face value. After all, the Washington Post documented in less than a year more than 2,000 false or misleading statements issuing from Donald Trump. That's 5 to 6 a day. So far, the reporting has proven to be far more true than the president's denials.
It kind of brings up the question that if Mr. Trump, and you know this is all speculative, but if he had done something like that, if he had fired Mueller, certainly the outrage or the attention that this would all receive would have been enormous.
That's, I think, why Counsel McGahn refused to carry out the order. You know, again, there are parallels to Watergate here. Nixon issued various outrageous orders as well that members of his staff did not carry out, most notoriously ordering the firebombing of records in the Brookings Institution. It's just extraordinary how many parallels in Watergate keep cropping up. It certainly would have been a crisis if he had actually fired the special counsel. We don't know what the consequences would have been. As you say, it was speculative. But the fact, and I'm presuming it's correct because there hasn't been a credible denial of lots of news outlets, not just the New York Times, but even Fox News, very favorable to Trump, has confirmed this. The ordering of the firing of Mueller is another piece of just an avalanche of evidence of obstruction of justice. Not just the firing of Comey, but the admission that he did it because of the Russia investigation, the asking of loyalty from Comey, the asking of Comey to let go the Flynn investigation, the pressuring of the CIA, the pressuring of the Justice Department, the pressuring of members of Congress to ease off the investigation, the palpably false explanation letter of the June 2016 meeting between Russian operatives and Don Jr., Jared Kushner, and Paul Manafort. God, it takes your breath away when you put it all together. And again, the parallels with Nixon are extraordinary. These were the kinds of things, this interference with a federal investigation that led to the House Judiciary Committee voting in favor of an obstruction of justice article against Richard Nixon. And one-third of Republicans joined the Democrats in voting for that article. So back then it was bipartisan, and Republicans did put country above party. I would hope they would do it again in objectively evaluating the situation facing Donald Trump the way they did with the situation facing Richard Nixon.
Alan Lichtman, professor of history at American University. A new report shows that smoking rates among Americans are at historic lows, but the U.S. still has one of the highest rates of tobacco-related deaths in the world. VOA's Carol Pearson tells us that the American Lung Association is pressing federal and state governments to do more to help smokers quit and to prevent teenagers from starting.
Every year, the American Lung Association issues its State of Tobacco Control Report. This year's report shows huge disparities in smoking rates between more educated, higher-income Americans and their less educated, lower-income counterparts. Overall, little more than 15% of Americans smoke, but the numbers rise significantly among low-income earners, those who live in government-subsidized housing, Native Americans, and some racial and ethnic groups. Among these groups, smoking rates are close to 30%. The report finds that states which offer smoking cessation programs to people with low incomes see smoking rates in this group fall. Thomas Carr, the association's director of national policy, says his organization is also calling for states to raise the age at which young adults can buy tobacco products to 21, since most people start smoking when they're still teenagers. So far, 5 states have done so.
But what it really does is it cuts off access for people 15 to 17 years old, because they a lot of times they'll go to their older friends who are 18 in high school, but they're not as likely to hang around with people who are 19 or 20 or 21.
And that, Carr says, further reduces younger teens' access to tobacco, as does raising taxes on cigarettes to make them less affordable for teens. Since 2003, the American Lung Association has been pushing states to make it harder for kids to smoke, mandate smoke-free workplaces, and fund programs and services to help smokers quit. Carr says there's still a lot of work to do. 38 million Americans smoke, and almost 500,000 die from tobacco-related causes each year. Despite the historic low in tobacco use, it remains the leading preventable cause of death and disease in the U.S. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. 3 major music artists have announced retirements this week after decades of performing. VOA's Jim Stevenson and Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald talk about the closing acts as the curtain comes down differently for each one.
Yesterday's songs don't seem to belong. They're here and they're gone. Yesterday's moves don't stay in the grooves, then keep moving on.
You know, for someone who's followed classic rockers for so many decades, it's sometimes a little disheartening, because if they're not dying, they're retiring. But that's what happens. Mm-hmm. Time marches on. And this week, 3 big acts announced that they are retiring from touring. The big one came on Monday when Neil Diamond said he was hanging it up. On his doctor's orders, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. Neil is 77 years old. He canceled the Australian and New Zealand legs of his 50th anniversary tour. He says he will remain active in writing and recording for as long as possible. And one nice result from this announcement is that his fans in New Zealand and Australia have responded by donating the money from their ticket refunds to Parkinson's research and other charities. And Neil has tweeted about that.
And I retweeted him on my Twitter feed, Ray on the Hits.
That's great.
So we certainly wish the best for Neil Diamond. And then on Wednesday, Elton John held a press conference saying he was retiring. However, this is going to come after a 3-year farewell tour. Elton says he wants to devote more time to his two young sons. Elton is 71 years old. He will kick off what he says will be his final tour on September 8th in Allentown, Pennsylvania. So I think Elton's leaving himself a little wiggle room here.
I think so.
A lot
yeah.
can happen.
We've seen
years.
This story before with a few artists who kind of toyed with it but kept going.
Haven't we? Yes, we have. Cher, Tina Turner.
Mm-hmm. Still on their farewell tours.
Right. Well, I think Tina pretty much has hung it up. She's living in Switzerland now. As for Cher, who knows what she's going to do. And finally, on Thursday, the members of Lynyrd Skynyrd said they will kick off their farewell tour on May 4th in West Palm Beach in their home state of Florida. It has been 45 years since they released their debut album. That's the one with Freebird on it. Mm-hmm. Lynyrd Skynyrd's best-known lineup ended in 1977 when three members died in a plane crash. Some people think Lynyrd Skynyrd may have broken up at that point. They did break up, but they reformed in 1987, and they have continued recording and touring since then. All three of these acts are members of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and what can I say? It's sobering to see time marching on.
Catch them while they're out there.
Catch them while you can.
Because they are fantastic.
That's right.
Still.
The clock is ticking on all of us.
We say farewell for the time being to Ray McDonald. He'll be back next week. And you can always catch Ray on Twitter.
At Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
Say goodbye to the tabloids. Say goodbye to Diet Soda. Say goodbye to new age music from the Kappa to the Coda.
And the music of Elton John brings us to a close of this show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Late on the evening of January 20th, several well-dressed men finished their dinner in the restaurant of the Kabul Intercontinental Hotel, got up from their chairs, took out assault rifles, and started shooting people. They then charged through the hotel's corridors, specifically looking to kill foreigners and officials of the Afghan government. The siege finally ended some 17 hours later, when Afghanistan's security forces, with support from Norwegian troops, killed the six terrorists. By that time, at least 22 people had been murdered by the attackers. The victims came from many countries: Ukraine, South Africa, Germany, Greece, Kazakhstan, Venezuela, the United States, and, of course, Afghanistan. This attack is part of a now familiar pattern. Over the past several months, the Taliban have been attacking cafes, hotels, and restaurants, anywhere that Afghan citizens could meet and speak with foreign visitors. The Taliban are focused on isolating Afghanistan and its citizenry from the rest of the global community, using egregious violence in an attempt to impose on them their twisted ideology. The Taliban deny the people of Afghanistan a life of peace and the opportunity to build a better community, a more comfortable life. The United States strongly condemns the attack at the Intercontinental Hotel in Kabul, said Secretary of State Rex Tillerson in a written statement. We mourn all those who lost their lives in the attack, whether Afghans or citizens of other countries. We offer our deepest condolences to the families and friends of those who were killed and wish for the speedy recovery of those wounded. The United States applauds the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces for their bravery in responding to the attack. We are in contact with Afghan authorities regarding their investigation of the incident. We have seen the Taliban's claim of responsibility and condemn terrorist groups for their violent campaign against Afghan and foreign personnel working to improve Afghanistan, said Secretary Tillerson. The United States stands with the government and people of Afghanistan. We remain firmly committed to supporting Afghan efforts to achieve peace, security, and prosperity for their country. Violence like what we witnessed in Kabul has no place in Afghanistan or anywhere else in the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United